This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
You are listening to the longest running, weekly, episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation.
Hot traveling fanboys. When you hear this show, you better run for cover.
Drum Dyke Bill's a sausage lover.
Ooh, hot traveling fanboys. It's a weekly podcast and you better listen.
They keep your ears in mid-condition.
We are still on the air, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another edition of the longest running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation. I'm Greg Phillips here in chilly Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. With me, as always, is Nick Duke. And if you're listening to this, that means you have either ignored or survived comic book theater. We eagerly anticipate any and all feedback to this controversial, somewhat unique, and dare I say it, attitudinal podcast entry from Place to Be Nation Pop. And you know, this episode of the Hard Traveling Fanboys is the latest installment of our series, Hard Travelers for Hire. And speaking of Place to Be Nation Pop, and speaking of comic book theater, we thought for this episode, which is focusing on Captain America, the Winter Soldier, the latest film in our monthly jaunt through the MCU, we should reach out to a member of the Place to Be Nation Pop crew, a member of Place to Be Nation Comic Book Theater. We should reach out to the man who just recently pinned Barry Windham to become the Western States Heritage Champion. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Tim Capel.
Greg, Nick, I'm not so sure I am looking forward to that feedback. Are we certain that we are still on the air? I mean, all of the podcasts on Place to Be Nation Pop could have been canceled, and they just haven't told us yet.
That's a good point. We are recording this, you know, without actually having confirmed with our Place to Be overlords that the Pop Network is still standing. So we could be sending this off into a proverbial black hole for it never to see the light of day. I don't know.
Yes, the three of us could be like the three Kryptonian criminals in Superman 2, just floating away in the Phantom Zone mirror. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless,
hurtling through space in a triangle.
In a triangle. Damn it! It could be right now, and that's fine. That's a great place to be. Some days I'd rather be there anyway. But on that note, we are here to talk about Captain America, and Tim, as the Captain America expert, we had you on to talk about the first Avenger. What was the level of excitement for you heading into the Winter Soldier?
Probably actually a little bit higher than my level of excitement for the first Captain America, the first Avenger film that – gosh, that goes back to, what was it, February, when we last convened for an edition of this. But I had not actually seen The Winter Soldier since I watched it in the theater. So we're going several years now. I mean, I've seen parts of it on television. It's been on FX here in recent months. But I haven't actually sat down to watch the whole film all the way through since my theatrical experience. So I was quite looking forward to revisiting it.
Excellent. Nick and I actually watched it together on the this came out in 2014, and that would have been the weekend of WrestleMania 30, and we went and watched it at a mall in New Orleans, as the locals call it. Is that the correct pronunciation, Nick?
I suppose so. Why do you ask me? I'm not a local.
Oh, but you've been around them more. Actually, you probably have it now that I think about it. So, yes, I'm just going to go with New Orleans. And in New Orleans, we went to the mall and watched this film there, Captain America the Winter Soldier, and quite enjoyed it, as I recall. Is my memory of that correct, Nick?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. I remember kind of walking out of it being really taken with the film. I wound up enjoying it much more than I was expecting. Not that I wasn't expecting to enjoy it, but this is one of those MCU films that really wowed me from the get-go, and my opinion of it has my opinion of it has at the very least maintained that level, if not raised a bit, in recent rewatches, as we will discuss over the course of the show.
Would it kind of snuck up on people, I felt like.
Yeah, I agree. I would even describe it as a handsome young film at this point.
Greg, I will say that Captain America, Steve Rogers, Chris Evans, if you will, he's a nice looking young man, is he not?
He is. He absolutely is. And
I mean, better without the mask, certainly.
Right. I think when he, you know, to me, why would you ever want to put a mask on that?
Right.
You see him, I mean, nice kid too. Shakes hands backstage. You know, didn't do all the lucha bullshit in every fight. So you know, I gotta say, I knew he had a future in the business.
I mean, no Tom Zink. Don't get me wrong, but
the hell is this?
He's a handsome young man.
Absolutely. This movie, obviously, the name is based on a famous run in the Captain America comics by Ed Brubaker, who brought Bucky Barnes, Captain America's long-dead sidekick character, back to life. We'll get into all that as we watch the film, but as we like to do with these, ladies and gentlemen, we like to watch the movies along with the podcast just to kind of remind us of things and keep the conversation moving. And so we've got our copies of the movie paused at 0 minutes and 0 seconds. And we invite you to take a moment to pause this podcast if you're listening from the comfort of your home and go and find your copy of The Winter Soldier and turn it on. And when you're ready again, you can resume. So presumably you're just now resuming the podcast. And if so, we're going to count you in to starting Captain America the Winter Soldier and starting our discussion of it in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, play. Or in my case, delayed play. And there it goes. So Captain America the Winter Soldier came off of the heels of a successful phase one of the MCU. And much like the first Avenger did before it, it serves as the bridge of sorts, correct, Nick, to the next phase of the MCU leading into Avengers Age of Ultron, which would bridge us into the next phase of the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Well, we did have Guardians of the Galaxy that came out right after this, but granted, Guardians was kind of a standalone thing, didn't really have much of an impact on Age of Ultron, and as we may or may not discuss, one of the post-credit scenes for this film directly sets up Age of Ultron. So I suppose you are correct in that assessment.
So now the big change in this one is gone is Joe Johnston, the director of the first Avenger. In his place are newcomers Anthony and Joe Russo. Now, usually you see the last name Russo and you think of great writing, great continuity, characters that stand the test of time.
Wow.
And
Tim Cable's funeral.
To excellence.
Wow.
But in this case, we weren't really sure what we were getting with these guys. I mean, had either of you heard much about the Russo brothers before this film?
I had heard nothing, for the record. Absolutely nothing. I knew they were taking over.
I'd never heard
anything else about them. So.
Well, they came in and they inherited a character who was enjoying probably the most popularity that Captain America as a character had experienced since the 1940s. I mean, it was an unprecedented, really, burst in popularity for Cap on a mainstream level in many ways. And it was, as I mentioned, based on a famous comic book run by Ed Brubaker. Now, I've never read Captain America the Winter Soldier by Brubaker, but I've heard great things about it. Nick, Tim, surely you've read it, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Is it as good as the reputation deserves?
I mean, I think so. I certainly am coming from a place of bias, being the longtime fan that I am. But you mentioned how the Marvel Cinematic Universe really had raised Cap's profile sort of in the public eye. And, you know, it occurs to me that he got a real big bump in the comics as well, which worked out, I think, nicely as sort of a lead-in and setting the stage for his cinematic exploits beginning in 2011, of course. The Winter Soldier storyline by Ed Brubaker, as you mentioned, that and Steve Epting largely handling the art on that, who is quite brilliant as well. That goes back to 2005, I believe, following on the heels of Avengers Disassembled, when Brian Michael Bendis basically inherited the Avengers franchise and breathed new life into it, or destroyed it, depending on your point of view and your fandom. You know, the Cap series that Brubaker started again in like 2005 from issue one, I think it was probably volume 4, volume 5 by that point of Cap's solo series. So, I mean, right from the get-go, it started off strong, and that storyline did the one thing that, as a Marvel reader, you felt like could never be done. And, I mean, I guess there's no sense beating around the bush. They bring back Bucky, and for years and years, that was the cliche, the sacred cow, right? Yeah, you the only characters that ever stay dead are Uncle Ben and Bucky. Well, so far, I believe Uncle Ben is still dead, but this did the seeming impossible and not only brought him back, killed the sacred cow, but did so in a really quite enjoyable story.
Yeah, and the success of that story and the renewed popularity in the comics of Captain America parlayed itself into Chris Evans and his, as we talked about back in February, his transformative performance as Captain America, which really reinvigorated this character in the national pop culture sense of the word, and set us up for this movie, which is an increased budget from the first one and had the weight of a lot of expectations coming off of some of the huge blockbusters that had already happened in the MCU. Obviously, at this point, we were expecting every MCU movie to be great. And this one has a screenplay by Christopher Markus and Stephen McFeely. Don't know much about them, but on my rewatch, I was struck by how good the writing was in this, that the dialogue is tight, the plot is interesting, and the way that it handles the whole Hydra and split, the Hydra and Shield split is really clever. And it actually, in a weird way, this one tied into Agents of Shield. Obviously, they did back half of the first season of Agents of Shield tied into this. And this just really, to me, exposed so many of the problems with that show. In the way that it handles Shield, the way that it handles Hydra, especially, is so much better than the way that the show ended up handling Hydra. But yeah, so the premise of this one, we start off, Cap is still trying to adjust to being in the modern day. You know, we've seen him in the Avengers after waking up from his, you know, 60 plus year coma, and he's back in the real world, the modern world, doing his thing, still trying to adjust. And he's carrying out these covert missions for S.H.I.E.L.D., but he's starting to question authority in a way that he never has before. He's asking questions. He's looking into things, and he's starting to wonder if maybe S.H.I.E.L.D. isn't living up to the values that he believes he represents with his S.H.I.E.L.D. And that sort of sets up the crux of this film, where we learn that, spoiler alert for a years-old movie, Hydra had been infiltrating S.H.I.E.L.D. from the very beginning. And the vast majority of S.H.I.E.L.D. agents were Hydra operatives, or at least S.H.I.E.L.D. administrators were Hydra operatives. And this forms the narrative crux of the movie. Cap trying to uncover this Hydra conspiracy and thwart their plans to launch an Ozymandias-like assault on American soil. And do their Hydra thing, essentially. So starting out here, what are your thoughts on the general story of the film? Nick, I'll start with you. How does this one pick up the pieces where the first Avenger and then the Avengers left off? And how do you think it does with picking those pieces up and then also doing its own thing?
First of all, it does a phenomenal job, I think, with picking up the natural evolution for the character that is set up in the Avengers. You know, in the Avengers, you bring him into the present day and you kind of see those scenes of, you know, Tony making fun of him, or Steve being amazed that he got a reference and stuff like that, making reference to his the fact that he's a man out of time. And so I like, you know, bringing that forward here, having it manifest itself in ways that aren't necessarily strictly comedic as they typically were in the Avengers. And just kind of continuing to move the character in an interesting direction. You know, you and I, Greg, both have always been kind of Captain America cynics, for the lack of a better term. You know, we've been hesitant to believe that he could be a really interesting and engaging character, but thus far in the MCU, they've proven us wrong in that respect. On the topic of the story of the film, I would argue that of all the MCU movies, this one might have the best plot in terms of it having some twists and turns along the way, it going to places you don't necessarily expect, and just kind of generally having you on the edge of your seat the entire time. I think this is a masterclass in MCU storytelling.
Yeah, I would agree. Tim, what are your thoughts on this one, story-wise?
Yeah, I think I, like you said before, Greg, I may not have given enough credit to the writing and the script of this film the first time around. You mentioned this is a good dialogue, really punchy, especially the banter between Cap and Natasha, as we're seeing in this kind of heist scene now. And you know, well paced, knows what it's doing, and the story is definitely I would agree. Maybe the strongest of any outing in the MCU. There's some bits towards the climax that I can kind of nitpick, but they aren't really complaints, so to speak. But the plot, yeah, to this film is really strong, and I love the Hydra infiltration aspect. Number one, because it gives our heroes some pretty disposable bad guys to knock around, which is always a treat. Mm-hmm. And principally, of course, number two is that you have this sort of espionage or political thriller that's playing out sort of in the margins of this movie. And, you know, that calls back to some of the earlier films of one Robert Redford, who we'll be seeing in due course, his 70s resume, stuff like 3 Days of the Condor and All the President's Men, which I think this movie kind of pulls from, but certainly with more of a superhero aesthetic and sheen to it. So, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, good point. And real quick, we'll get into more of that, but I want to throw some attention to the fight that we're watching right now as Cap is battling Batroc, the comic book character Batroc the Leaper, here as Georges Batroc, played by UFC welterweight champion at the time, Georges Rush St. Pierre, who is making his feature film debut, I believe, and does a really good job of doing what's asked of him. He plays a sort of a French mercenary Batroc. It was a very, very familiar to Cap fans of the comics. And this was the first scene in the movie where I realized this was going to be different than the rest of the MCU. Because, Tim, you and I and others have talked about one of the weaknesses of the MCU is that the fight scenes aren't very good usually, and mm-hmm. or at least very memorable. And as a guy that, like, I'm big on fight scenes. I love great fight scenes. This has probably, if you're putting together the five best fight scenes of the MCU, this probably has three of them in it, and this is one of them. This is a just an awesome start to the movie, and showing you a difference in the way the scene is shot, the way that it's created, the way it tells a story, in that usually the MCU fight scenes to this point really hadn't told much of a story within the fights. Some of them had, but for the most part, they were just sound and fury. And here we had a nice hand-to-hand fight showing Cap's skills, even without the shield. He puts the shield down, and he still is able to take out Batroc, who's clearly got a lot of skill. I don't know this for a fact, but I would assume that GSP, being a true fighter, added a lot to the choreography in this movie and made it a little bit more realistic, made it look a little more stiff, for lack of a better term, a little more believable in the hand-to-hand elements. And to his credit, Chris Evans is up for every bit of it and looks the part of a guy who can kick ass in a hand-to-hand fight. So really, really enjoyed that scene with GSP. But I think the fight scenes in general in this film were so wonderful and such a big step up. The fight at the end with Cap and the Winter Soldier on the helicarrier is tremendous. Their first fight with each other is tremendous. It's just a different level from what we had seen to this point in the MCU.
And by the way, we're 12 minutes. That fight was 12 minutes into this movie. I mean, they yep. hit the ground running with this, and it does something really cool and that people have been calling for pretty much since the dawn of superhero movies, which is give us like a B-list sort of disposable villain just to kind of give us that hot opener, right? Where it's mm-hmm. it's not necessarily critical to the plot, or that this is not a major antagonist for the hero, but gives a little shine to maybe a lesser known villain from the comics and do right by them. And I think this is one of the few movies to actually do that.
Yeah, absolutely. I was gonna say that whole extended boat sequence to open, not just the Batroc portion, but really that entire extended action sequence is really, really good. One of the better long form action sequences they probably had in one of these films. I was completely captivated by it on this most recent rewatch.
Same here. It had been a while since I'd seen this one, and it really sucked me right into the movie and got me. It's to the point where I was like, God, I can't put this down. I got to watch this whole thing. Like, it's so good. Mm-hmm. And the fights are crisp throughout. We'll get to a few of the other ones as we see them. But, you know, later on I mentioned the helicarrier fight with Cap and the Winter Soldier, which is just really good with you know, I marked out because he actually does a BJ Penn move in it where he traps his arm while he's got him in a rear naked choke, which is pretty cool. And
there's a German suplex at one point, too.
There's a German suplex, yes. There is a German suplex from Cap to Bucky, which is tremendous. That whole sequence, which I think we might actually get to that one, where they're in the streets and it's Cap and Natasha and the Falcon against Winter Soldier and random Hydra thugs, is one of the best action sequences in the MCU. But to something – I wanted to mention a point that you brought up, Tim, which is that this really plays out as more of an espionage / political thriller, mm-hmm. which is something we had not seen in certainly the MCU, maybe in superhero movies at all to that point. And I think that's another one – another reason why this sticks out is because so much of the – and I don't want to say complaints because I think everybody pretty well enjoys the MCU. But I think one of the nitpicks that people have is that some of the movies tend to feel a little samey, and this one does not. This one feels unlike anything we had seen before or since, in the same way that Guardians was unlike anything we had seen before to that point. What do you think about – Nick, would you agree with that this has a different – different kind of vibe to it than the rest of the MCU.
Yeah, I mean, I think Phase 2 was kind of where we started to see each of these films start to try and have their own identity. You know, those subgenres within the genre that we've talked about. This one very clearly tries to be a political thriller. In the case of something like Guardians of the Galaxy, it's this cosmic kind of Star Warsian comedy film. And then, of course, with Ant-Man later on, you'll get, you know, the heist movie.
A heist film.
In the superhero genre. So it's interesting how here in Phase 2 they started to branch out a little bit. But yeah, I would definitely agree that even up through what we've seen, I think the closest to this one, and it makes sense, is probably Captain America Civil War. But even that one is more of an out-and-out action movie than this one, which really has that political intrigue factor cranked up to 11.
One of the aspects as well, we were talking about the dialogue. We saw it a minute earlier, the interactions between the characters in this movie. But where Cap and Nick Fury, right now, they're having this almost antagonistic discussion with one another, where Cap is questioning why Fury lied to him about this mission at the beginning of the film. What all is he keeping from him? Fury is doing the whole, you know, some secrets exist for a reason. That's great. Natasha and Cap, to me, have the best chemistry in this movie, to the point where it actually retroactively makes me even more frustrated that they did a Black Widow and Hulk romance in Age of Ultron, because she has so much more chemistry with Cap as a character. It's just off the charts in this movie. They're great together. Obviously, Cap and Bucky are, as enemies, have good chemistry with each other. And then Robert Redford, you know, the first time I saw this movie, I have to admit, I was like, you know, I don't really see the big deal. I was like, it's kind of a waste of Robert Redford because he didn't really do much. And now watching it this time, I was like, holy cow, the guy added so much to this role, because he underplays it. Like he's understated the entire time, and it really serves the movie, and it helps multiple rewatches of it as well.
Yeah, I think he's fucking great in this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And does add a lot, like you said. And as a matter of fact, this is maybe getting ahead a little bit, but I was way more glued to like what his sort of scheming and machinations were up to, even more so than, you know, the Winter Soldier. I mean, the Winter Soldier is kind of just a means to an end. He's there as kind of the implacable disposable assassin, in a sense, not to be confused with Scud, of course. Wow, that's a deep cut. Ladies and gentlemen, I apologize. But yeah, I mean, I was way more into what was going on around him, just in his head and in terms of the plot that's laid out in front of us.
Particularly that they make it a point that even though he's – as we see in the film, he gets progressively more evil as the film goes on. He murders his maid and whatnot. But despite all that, they make it a point to show you that he does actually have respect for Nick Fury, and that he does actually, in his own twisted way, think that he's doing what's right for the world. And he does it in a way that makes sense, where it's not like it doesn't come off like a supervillain monologue. It just comes off like a politician explaining his way out of something. You know, it's very, very understated, very believable, very unlike what you would expect in this movie. It would have been easy to ham up that role, I feel, and he doesn't.
Not to interrupt you guys from the point, but right now we're seeing probably one of the more realistic examples of like old person makeup I've ever seen in a film. I think they did a phenomenal job on aging up Peggy Carter for her little cameo here.
Do you think they did a better job than the Richard Nixon makeup in Watchmen?
Much, much better, for sure.
I think this is actually CGI'd, which is somewhat ironic because there's not a lot of CGI, as compared to other superhero movies in this. But it's definitely more subtle here, where she doesn't look
rubber.
She doesn't look like Grand Moff Tarkin, you know?
Yeah.
Grand Moff Tarkin, yeah.
And I mean, this is kind of a sad scene, in fact, just
very much so,
between just the contrast of how we last saw Agent Carter and Captain America, the First Avenger, and her situation now. And it's about to take an even more tragic turn here where this actually really kind of choked me up watching
me
it back.
Too. What last night? Yeah, this got me too. This is especially so many of us have been through this with family members, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. it's definitely brings back memories, and the way that he handles it is like. Yeah. If that's not – to me, and this is a weird thing to say, of all the scenes in this movie, that might be the most Captain America scene to me in the movie. And maybe I'm off because I haven't read a lot of Captain America comics, but that's – I've always told you this, Tim, and I know that it's not exactly the same thing, but I've always viewed him as kind of like a Superman parallel, and that is exactly how Superman would handle that scene. And it really – like it touches me every time I watch it, and it's like that is why, as Ben Morse puts it, Captain America has to be the best person. And he comes off as that in this movie. He just comes off as the best person.
You actually see his humanity there. I mean, we kind of get the mission and the very values-oriented part of Cap. I mean, we get that. We see it play out, and it can frankly get kind of tired, you know, seeing someone who's that bread-and-butter superhero, just gee-golly, hokum, whatever.
Leonardo. Right.
Yeah, I mean, you know how it is with these types of characters, which and I think the Superman comparison is apt. But when you actually see his humanity in a situation like that, it drives it home a lot more.
Yeah, and we're about to see the famed Mr. Lau appear from The Dark Knight as a hologram.
Oh, no kidding! Yeah,
there he is. Yeah. He calculated he'd become
Didn't
a hologram.
Catch that the first time around, or the second time around, for that matter.
I think that guy has it in his contract that he has to appear in every comic book adapted universe, because we've seen him in The Dark Knight, we've seen him in Captain America. I believe he's been on the CW DC universe as well in a role, and it feels like there was another recent comic book movie that he's been in as well. But that guy he gets around in comic book circles. He might be the link. He might be the link for the future Amalgam movie that gets made.
Oh, is
he going to play Access?
He'll be Access.
Oh, man.
And let's not forget Paul Rudd's Russian friend from Ant-Man, who was also the crazy dude from The Dark Knight that the Joker used in that one scene.
Allegedly crazy.
Are we led to believe this is the same Security Council scene in Shadow and the Avengers, where they don't really reveal their faces? And if so, I guess Powers Booth got replaced in between Avengers and Winter Soldier.
Yes, because didn't Powers Booth?
Powers Booth
I always get
was
him
the
confused
one
that, with Rutger Hauer. He was on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Right?
Okay, now I'm getting them confused.
Powers Booth. One of them. Recently on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Not back in this time.
Well, Powers Booth would eventually be revealed to be a major Hydra power player in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. in a convoluted season that I didn't enjoy, where they ruined Hydra for me. But yeah, this is
Agents
great.
Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, we're not here to talk about Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. We're here to talk about how awesome Robert Redford and Sam Jackson are. I also loved – it felt like this movie gave us a different side of Nick Fury as well, a more vulnerable side of Nick Fury, I guess you would say, where he genuinely doesn't have the answers in this situation. He's so used to being – and we're used to as an audience seeing him in these movies be the guy that has all the answers, the guy who's playing chess in the background, you know, with everybody else's lives. And here – he's starting to question if maybe he's one of the pieces instead of the player. And that's something that we see play out over the course of this movie, and it's about to lead to another outstanding action sequence here in a moment. But one of the new additions to this film is this guy, Anthony Mackie, as the Falcon. To me, one of the best parts of this movie. Totally caught me off guard. Falcon is a huge blind spot for me as a character. I don't think I had ever read the Falcon in a comic book in my life. And fell in love with the character over the course of this movie. I think Mackie's performance is so endearing. The way that they imagine this character for the modern era is really endearing. And he adds, again, just a different element to the film and a kind of character that can approach Cap from the outside of the superhero community and kind of as somebody that's coming into the superhero community for the first time, really, really enjoy Mackey in all these movies. But this introduction to him made him a favorite of mine. What do you guys make of the addition of the Falcon, and how does it compare to his comics counterpart?
Well, much like you, Greg, I don't really have a ton of experience with the Falcon in the comics. Most of my exposure to him has come in the last few years, actually, as he's enjoyed something of an elevated role in the Marvel Comics universe. So I didn't really have much of a baseline to compare it to, but I will say I very much enjoyed his performance. He's one of the more likable, believably likable characters in the film. You know, not quite the level of patriotic perfection that Steve Rogers has, but kind of an everyman, if that makes sense, even though he's not really an everyman.
Yeah, I would say both the character and the actor, Anthony Mackie, do bring a lot to this film. Falcon, really superb, longtime Captain America partner. And I was just thrilled to see that he, you know, made it into the Marvel Cinematic Universe. One of those characters I think would be easy to overlook, but makes a lot of sense alongside Cap. Never been like a favorite, tippy top favorite of mine, but someone who I think I've always appreciated and always thought deserved a lot more than he got, at least probably until recent years. But I really do like the take on him in this movie. It does make a lot of sense. That said, the sheer coincidence of Steve Rogers befriending this veteran who just so happened to have this somewhat experimental this jetpack with wings that he used in military operations. That was a bit much for me, even as in a superhero movie, in terms of suspending my disbelief, but I get it. That just comes with the territory in these things.
This scene is one of my favorites in the movie, by the way.
Yeah,
I mentioned it a minute ago, the assault on Nick Fury in the street as his talking car is, it pretty much explaining to him how dire the situation is. This is just great. He fires back. Really great action. It looks – I don't know for a fact that it is, but it looks practical. It looks like a lot of practical effects mm-hmm. here, and it makes a difference. And it just comes off as aggressive and badass and pulse-pounding. I remember watching this in the theater, and with that movie surround sound going – it was like, you know, I don't know about you, but I was like just almost sweating. Well, I'm always sweating, but I felt like my natural state of sweating was even enhanced by the thrilling nature of the scene. As now we're about to get our first look at the Winter Soldier.
And it's just a really cool example of like showcasing some S.H.I.E.L.D. technology without having to watch Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. You know, we've seen the Helicarrier and Avengers and some little gadgets here and there in the Iron Man films, but this is a really cool example of some of that high-level James Bond type shit that you know S.H.I.E.L.D. probably has at their disposal.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tense scene. I mean, you feel like he's really in peril here, even though you're reasonably sure that Nick Fury is going to survive.
It's one of two really, really good like car chase sequences in the film. And it's so so interesting because, you know, a lot of car chases today – I guess because we've seen them done to death and they feel kind of played out, it's interesting that this one manages to have two that are really tense and really successful.
This one is shot so well that from the kind of lower angle on the bottom of the cars, you know, that make them seem like they're going even faster than they are. It's a technique that we see in again, this ties into our earlier theme of the espionage genre, because to me, this is reminiscent of the Bourne Supremacy and the Bourne Ultimatum, Paul Greengrass. This is kind of his style of car chase scene. And those movies probably had the best modern car chase scenes. And this kind of takes some of those cues and adds some really cool elements to it. And there's a scene that was reminiscent of Commando. If you recall the scene when Cook commits his first kill on the used car salesman at the beginning of Commando, nice – Even though it's probably not an homage to that, I'm going to
– Yeah, I'm not sure the camera lingered as long as it needed to there, but
We didn't get a pun. We didn't get a pun either, so
– No, that's a shame. But yeah, I mean, you got to have a good car chase in a spy movie. You have to.
Here's my question. Why is nobody seemingly reacting to the fact that the cops are firing full machine guns out their windows across other vehicles towards Nick Fury?
I mean, I just think that's standard
standard police protocol. Activity.
You know, I'm gonna leave that alone. I'm really going to leave that alone.
Oh, goodness.
Oh. He's never mind.
He's got an eye patch is what you're getting at.
Yeah. Yes. Thank you. He was profiled for his eye patch, no doubt.
That's a cool weapon right there.
Oh, yeah. That was
that is.
Magnetized bomb deal.
Tremendous.
Yeah.
And as you said, this is our first look at the titular, brustular, right?
Brustular.
We're going to go with brustular. Yes.
You're going with brustular.
Yeah. Brustular character.
This is a badass look for the Winter Soldier, I have to say.
It's fairly comics accurate. I mean, not really you know, that far outside the purview of the page.
How confident was Nick Fury that he would be able to burn a hole through the ground conveniently to the sewer below? Pretty confident, I imagine.
Yeah, you get the sense maybe that wasn't his first rodeo.
And also, here's the other thing. I got to say, I think the mask is cool on the Winter Soldier. I wish he had kept it for most of the movie.
If there's a wrestling equivalent to that, I think that was like Kane's debut in the Hell in the Cell.
Mm-hmm.
He just walks on scene and fucks shit up.
Exactly. And you know, shit just got real.
Wears a cool mask, like you said. But yeah, I like the mask too, certainly.
Has a fat guy in the background yelling in a high-pitched voice.
And here's Sharon Carter that Steve doesn't know it's Sharon Carter yet.
Mm-hmm.
I got to be honest. Sharon Carter does nothing for me in these movies.
Well, she's barely been in. I mean, she has a pretty small role in this one. And then in Civil War, she's in what, like two scenes?
She's in more than two scenes in Civil War. She's in several scenes.
She's in the funeral scene, giving the eulogy that I can recall. And
yes, and repurposing a Captain America speech from the comics in a somewhat unusual way in Civil War. Yeah, I mean, she doesn't have a ton of presence even in the scene she's in. I feel like they sort of the filmmakers realized how weird, frankly, the romance between them would look and is, and they don't shy away from it, but they don't go all in on that relationship like they do in the comics.
Right.
And they do a good job of keeping that subtle for those who may not know who, you know, who Sharon Carter is or who what's going on exactly. I think they did a good job of playing that off. Here's another good scene with Fury, even though it doesn't work, Fury trying to keep it low key and sneak into Cap's apartment and make sure that things are kept on the down low, which I don't know that Cap is the guy you want to try that with, because he's a bit on the naive side. So he'd be kind of like trying to have a subtle, you know, non-obvious conversation with me. At Nick, you may have had those with me in the past where you're trying to code language with me, and I'm not quite getting what you're driving at, and being a bit too earnest in my discussion.
Yeah, I was about to say he's really frustratingly earnest.
Speaking of frustratingly earnest, I think Earnest Scared Stupid was the shark jumping one for me.
Oh, no question. Well, I mean, goes to jail at the end where – doesn't the bad guy like turn into Electro?
He doesn't really turn into Electro. He just gets electrocuted, mm-hmm. if memory serves. And then like I just remember Ernest in an electric chair flying through a ceiling. But I may be imagining that. But yeah, I love Goes to Jail though. But yeah, Scared Stupid to me was just – a bridge. It started that bridge too far, and it was probably the last decent one. And then, I mean, I don't know if you've seen them, but some of those ones that came after are so
bad. Slam Dunk Ernest is among the worst things ever put on film.
Slam Dunk Ernest. Ernest Goes to Africa was horrible.
I forgot about Ernest Goes to Africa.
And they all are shot to look like they were like, you know those episodes of Raw that take place in London and how they all look different? That's how these look. And they're not good is what I'm getting at. But nevertheless, again, we're not as much as I'd love to do a podcast on the Ernest series, and we may at some point in the future.
Yeah, we should do that.
We're not here to talk about it now. This is a great
scene.
Co-op
Jordan Duncan's rank and file for a top five Ernest films.
Top five Ernest films, which could cause some debate because I know you and I, Nick, are in somewhat strong disagreement about which is the top Ernest movie.
That's true.
So I'm a Goes to Jail man, and you're a Saves Christmas.
Saves Christmas. What are you eating, by the way?
Oh, I'm just chewing gum. I'm not eating anything.
Okay, just checking.
I forgot to get something to drink before the podcast, so.
As did I.
So the Cap's trying to figure out, you know, who this mysterious assailant is who has taken out Nick Fury. Now, here's something I want to ask you guys, because I'll be honest. I bought into this. Did you guys buy into the Nick Fury death at the time?
Not really. Because I was thinking, this is how they would introduce LMDs into the MCU. I thought for sure they were going to go Life Model Decoy and just go full Marvel Comics on us, but that's not the route they were going.
Well, maybe that's a third reason actually, but I was thinking number one, they pulled this trick with Commissioner Gordon and the Dark Knight, and that was somewhat unconvincing that time. So, fool me once, can't get fooled again. But mainly it's the fact that Samuel L. Jackson is contracted for like 17 of these movies or whatever.
That's a good point.
And this was like his, what, fifth or so? Sixth? I don't know.
Yeah,
he had not fulfilled that contract just yet.
I bought into it because I didn't think they would do the fake S.H.I.E.L.D. death thing again like they did with Avengers, with Coulson. Even though that one, you can argue whether it's canonical or not, because in my head canon, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. isn't canonical with the MCU anymore. But you know, I when I watched this movie in the theater, I was like, oh shit, surely they're not going to do a fake death again. So I think they might have actually killed Fury, especially since we see him dying. But I should have known, Tim, from years of watching Days of Our Lives and how many times Stefano faked his death, I should have known. I should have known there was some sort of drug that would simulate the effects of death and that the Phoenix would rise again. And in this case, he did.
We do see a body. You're right.
Yeah. And
looking
usually
right at it.
Yeah. And that usually you could argue that's manipulative towards the audience. I don't mind it because it works in the context. And I don't actually want to see Nick Fury dead, and it doesn't bother me as much as the Coulson thing did. But, yeah, you can make the argument that it's deceptive. But it to me, I'm okay with being tricked once in a while, and I think this one was fine. I'm willing to fall on that, that I was the dumb one that fell for the Nick Fury death. As we see Maria Hill show up, which I have some questions about her role later in the film that we'll perhaps
not
to. You probably know where I'm going with that.
I think so.
But so again, we see more of this vulnerable side of both Cap and especially Natasha, who we haven't really seen humanized much in the films to this point. Here we do, as she clearly has some level of affection for Nick. Fury, that is, not Nick Duke. Don't get excited.
So says you.
Sparky. Goodness.
Yep.
But nevertheless, as I just said, I think for the first time in this episode.
Oh, you know, if you're feeling self-conscious about your transitions and your supposed overuse of that word, might I suggest another one? You could always go NWO Wolfpack era Conan in terms of awkward and stilted deliveries and transitions and throw in a more importantly than all of that.
More importantly than all of that. Mm-hmm. The Wolfpack Somos Unos Pacos Locos forever.
I wasn't going to attempt it, but I'm glad that you did.
You know them strawberries in the black and the white, they be talking about they for life. Yeah. I knew the Conan spiel pretty good back in the day.
Right. I couldn't remember if he threw in that part before or after the
– I remember him yelling at Kevin Nash that he was – he wanted him to – was it toss his salad and peel his potatoes?
Lex Luger too.
Now, oh, God.
To quote Glenn Butler, we're just talking about food for preparation on the show.
good Lord. Oh,
God's sakes.
A cavalcade of greatness that era was. But speaking of cavalcade of greatness, here we get Robert Redford's Lincoln. What is his name? Alexander Pierce. I always want to call him Lincoln Pierce or Franklin Pierce, who I think was a president. In fact, I know he was a president. So,
holding up presidents on.
We are. We're going to – let's do F, Mary, Kill with Pierces.
Oh.
Never mind.
Famous Pierces, F, Mary, Kill, right?
All right, yes. Alexander Pierce, yep. Franklin Pierce.
Donald Pierce from Logan.
Oh, yes, yes. All right, I'm going to go – okay. This is actually quite difficult. I'm going to go F, Donald Pierce from Logan.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to go marry Alexander Pierce, even though he's a Hydra agent. He's old and he's probably going to die soon. And Robert Redford's, even in his old age, a pretty handsome man. And I'm going to have to kill former President Franklin Pierce.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the same. Same
thing. Yeah, it's a hat trick.
Yep.
Wow.
I feel like that was an anticlimactic F, Mary, Kill. No debate, no discussion. Pretty cut and dry there.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. I felt like the dog sitting next to me right now might try to punctuate that. So if you hear any strange noises, just know I am not dying. I'm not having a seizure or a stroke, but you may hear some unusual sounds because this one can get kind of talkative. So anyway.
Well, you know who's not very talkative in portions of this movie? Alexander Pierce. But he is right here as we see him.
Great transition.
Thank you. Looking out upon the not looking sure out it's upon true, his creation. Okay. No, it's not. He talks a lot in the movie, but quite frankly, here we Cap gets confronted with something that was pointed out to him earlier by Black Widow in a great scene, that he's a terrible liar.
Yes.
And
frustratingly earnest and honest.
That comes back to haunt him here as he is incapable of telling convincing lies to Alexander Pierce. And it is about to turn him into a fugitive from justice. This
one of the other great things about the Pierce character is he's pulling all these strings and manipulating people, but in a way where he's making them think that they're not carrying out his orders, but that his ideas are actually their ideas. And that's like the most effective and the most devious way of just worming your way to the
right
to the top, you know, and that's exactly what Hydra has done here.
Right. Absolutely. It's actually, to me, the way that he manipulates the panel in that way, Tim, where he makes them think – it's almost like a reverse psychology thing. Mm-hmm. It's very Lex Luthor.
Yes.
Good Lex Luthor, not crappy adaptation Lex Luthor.
Not real estate tycoon Lex Luthor.
Right, but businessman Lex Luthor. It's very much of that vein. That's how Lex is in his
not
best
Eisenberg Lex iterations. Luthor, huh?
No, there are no Jolly Ranchers involved in this.
Oh, God.
But he – The way that he manipulates people is through making them think that they're the ones that want to do this. I know the Justice League animated series did a great job of that version of Lex Luthor. And so Alexander Pierce again, provides a new twist on a type of villain that we've seen before in the MCU, that sort of, I don't know, bureaucrat that is running things from behind the scenes. We've seen that in some of the Iron Man movies and elsewhere in the MCU, but we haven't seen it done quite like this, where it's a really convincing manipulator, where somebody that isn't going to be felled by his ego and isn't going to be felled by being a megalomaniac, he comes off as a real conniving dude. And it's certainly a step below a sort of cartoonish character like Justin Hammer or like Loki or someone like that, who is a villain that, you know, is very theatric, very into themselves or insecure in the case of Justin Hammer. He's very confident. Pierce is a very confident character. I did want to ask, how do you guys feel Pierce would have reacted had Cap actually told him the truth in that scene? Would he have still tried to have Cap killed, or would he have tried to convert him to his side?
Oh, he definitely would have tried to have him killed. Like, that was clearly part of his game plan from the get-go, and I think he just kind of talked Cap into playing right into it. I think he knows enough to know that Captain America, as we've said, is so damn earnest and just so damn righteous that there was no way he was going to convert to that side, seeing as how he was already having ideological conflicts with Nick Fury before all this started.
Yeah, too much of a liability. He just wanted to kind of see how he would react and what his next move from there needed to be, which leads to this another great action scene in the elevator.
Oh, yes, which includes the genesis, not of McGillicuddy, but of Crossbones. And I don't know much about Crossbones, but I know, Tim, that he's a character you know a lot about. And what did you think of the way that this movie – of course, we see him in his full Crossbones garb in a different movie. But how did you think about – what did you think about how this movie imagined that character and his sort of – transition from legit S.H.I.E.L.D. agent into Hydra operative, I guess.
Well, and as we see him getting his shit pushed in just a minute here, somewhat mixed feelings about his depiction in this movie. On the one hand, it makes a lot of sense, and I'm glad that a character like that made it into the movie. Here again, somewhat classic Cap character, one of my favorites anyway, and a character that got a big boost here again under Ed Brubaker in the early 2000s. So I was really looking forward to how he would come off in this movie, but it's more building up to the character he'll become here than full-on Crossbones. And in that sense, I was a little bit disappointed. I mean, I wanted to see the mask and the skull and crossbones and all that, as we do, but I do kind of admire the restraint they show and not going there. And that's something that is sort of a theme throughout this movie, and the way that they do show restraint and don't give in to kind of the fanboyish knee-jerk inclinations that we kind of have, things we want to see but wouldn't necessarily serve the story. I think that is an example of that. So the way that they do it, I think, works, and the movie is the better for it. But, you know, you do still kind of want to see that more theatrical type character.
Yeah, and that's something that level of restraint, though, is something that I kind of, as much as I would love to see these characters all at once, I admire them for doing that, as opposed to trying to fit everything into one movie. As long as they knew they were going to do another Cap movie, I feel like they had that ace in their pocket that they could pull out when the time was right. And I think there's something to be said for that versus the approach that they sometimes go into in superhero movies, where they try to cram the Sandman, Venom, and the Green Goblin into one movie, for instance.
Talk about restraint. I mean, I almost thought we were going to get a Red Skull reveal with Pierce.
Yeah, I did too when we were watching it the first time. I remember that as well.
And I'm not sure – again, it's one of those, like, I would have marked out huge if they did that. but would it have made sense? Would it have been the right call? Probably not.
Yeah.
So, and I'm sure, I mean, that had to be something that was discussed, because it's very much a Red Skull thing to do. I mean, he's pulled that move a lot of times in the comics. So, I mean, they probably could have gotten away with it, but you do have the potential of that being a shark jumping moment, you know?
Oh, yeah. Here's a great moment where Natasha kind of outsmarts Cap a little bit, or figure the fact that she figured out what his brilliant plan was to hide this USB drive. One thing I wanted to point out, we saw a minute ago a scene that I wanted to talk about. I appreciated the fact that the S.H.I.E.L.D. heel turn, the Hydra agents in S.H.I.E.L.D., they didn't just go the usual route of them all being faceless, nameless S.H.I.E.L.D. operatives that we don't know. We actually saw some characters, one in particular, who we had already seen as good guys, quote unquote, even in other movies or in the TV universe, turn into villains, which is very unusual. And in this case, it was Jasper Sitwell. Sitwell by name, Sit very well by reputation. And we see him be revealed as the movie progressed as a Hydra operative who was in on the whole thing. And that really caught me off guard. I didn't see it coming, because I was watching Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. regularly, and he was on that show regularly to that point as a good guy, as one of the respected members of S.H.I.E.L.D. I thought that was a really clever twist on things.
Yeah, I would agree completely. Yeah,
it does add a little something. Go ahead, Nick.
No, yeah, pulling in Gary Shandling for a cameo, you know, just to name a couple. Like you said, Greg, pulling in established characters from throughout the MCU just kind of adds to that reveal. So yeah, I dug that as well.
Yeah, Tim, you were saying something as well.
And certainly, not that we've seen him in any other movies, but Rumlow, who we saw in the beginning as seemed like a good guy or a good enough type guy.
Even delivering a line where he was, you know, admiring Cap at the beginning.
Yes.
The first was like, did he just leave without a parachute? Yes, he did. You know, like it almost felt like he had admiration for Cap.
And he's somewhat self-deprecating, too, on the ship, where he says something like, oh, yeah, looks like you really needed the help. He's not playing the tip. I guess the point is he's not playing the typical macho douchebag where they're totally, you know, hinting at he's going to make a heel turn, or he's already a heel.
Right. So that added to it, and I love this scene with them undercover, and this is adding to my Jennifer, you're going to love this, my fanfic-esque shipping of Cap and Black Widow now, because this is, again, a really convincing scene, reminiscent once again of Bourne. If people have seen, I think it's in Bourne Supremacy, where he and his then girlfriend go undercover. It might have been actually in the original Bourne Identity, and they're kind of trying to keep their cover low and stay hidden at this mall. And it's really well done. It's brilliantly done. And here's this awesome Apple representative who's coming to sell them something.
Yeah. Yes. And he's quite shocked that they are supposedly going to be honeymooning in New Jersey.
What are they trying to say with that, Tim?
I don't know, but I feel like Ben Morris is due an apology.
I think that may be a rib at his expense, even.
Maybe so, could be, but I kind of like Cap and Natasha as platonic coworkers, where they're very close, intimate, in fact. But there's not going to be any romance between them. I mean, I get the whole shipping thing, but it just – that stuff just seems so played out to me. I'm so tired of love interests in these movies and forced romances, which this wouldn't be forced because they do have such good chemistry. It's just I don't need it in my Captain America movie. And I'm glad they didn't go there. Not just with her, but with anybody. We talked about Sharon Carter earlier, but, I mean, even that doesn't really amount to anything. And they even call attention to how awkward it is. So I think that's one of the things they really get right by this character, or at least get right by me, I suppose.
Wouldn't it be great if Cap fell in love with someone at the nursing home because they're actually closer to his age?
Oh, well, there's something. Yeah, that'd be quite the twist. I mean, he spends a lot of time there.
But no, yeah, I kind of agree with Tim. I'm kind of glad they didn't go a full-out relationship route with this. I mean, I know they have good chemistry and there's definitely some tension there. But, I mean, it's the Black Widow. There should kind of be sexual tension between her and practically every character. I was going to say every male character, but between her and practically every character in the MCU, really, because that's kind of this one of the many tools she has at her disposal, even in her relationships with those she considers to be friends.
Fair enough, Norm. Is this where they're going? I'm trying to remember where this is in the movie. Is this where they're going to Zola?
They're going to the old army compound where Steve Rogers was trained.
Where they're going to meet an individual that I believe is known as That Old Fuck Zola. Is that correct, Nick?
Something like that. That Old Fuck Artem Zola. Sadly, because he's digital as opposed to tangible, there are no Four Locos, no dick pills, no somas, nothing.
Oh, God. He is no fun. He's just a no-fun Nazi. That's Zola.
Well, it's a hellish existence he's been confined to. Supposedly, they were sophisticated enough that they could upload his consciousness, his mind, if you will, and preserve this after the expiration, the demise of his physical form. But on the physical media that existed at the time, I don't know. Is that what he's limited to? Could you put him on a USB drive nowadays? Could you? What kind
yes.
of
what once what took an entire facility now is just a USB drive.
Yeah, I don't know what kind of space requirements, but it just, you know, the point is computing has come a long way since the 70s when this would have happened, but he ought to have some options, but maybe he doesn't. Maybe they're – it's just like, you know, people who die and elect to be cryogenically frozen, the technology to resuscitate these people, you know, hundreds of years – perhaps thousands of years into the future, it's like you figure something better would have come along in the interim to keep people around. I mean, that's going to be real weird, don't you think?
Yeah, but you know what's going to be really weird is when we all look like jackasses when Ted Williams comes back to life in 3014 and he's alive again, and he was right and we were all wrong.
Greg, the planet will be destroyed by nuclear war long before 3014, but – you keep on with that dream.
Maybe that nuclear war will melt Ted Williams and he'll come back to life.
Maybe he will. Ted Williams will come back to us now at the turn of the tide.
And Walt Disney too.
Walt Disney had himself frozen?
That was one of those urban legends, but it was just the head.
Oh, man. That's my favorite. I hope the future is like Futurama. That's what I hope, to be honest.
Just the head.
I hope Richard Nixon's head is a real thing that happens.
Just the head, Jesus. Just to see how it feels.
I'm going to talk like this. It's going to be awesome.
Bringing it back to – ooh, here's Preacher.
Oh, yeah. Jesse Custer.
Jesse Custer.
Jesse Custer. Hey, by the way –
hey.
I wanted to bring up another thing that I forgot to mention earlier on, a great – and I have no idea if this was intentional or not, if they already had this all planned out. I'd like to hope that they did. When at the end of the movie, when Natasha gives Cap the file about Winter Soldier's history, and I think that the file has the Starks in it.
No, that actually is coming up here in just a few minutes as Zola recounts the ways that Hydra has subtly affected history.
But what I was going to say is, like, at some point Natasha gives him a file, I think, and yes. She says, "You better be careful. You may not want to pull on those threads." And it kind of prefaces what comes in Civil War later on.
Yes.
That Cap has access to this information that he keeps from everyone else, in particular from Tony.
That is true, and that definitely could be read that way. I do wonder if already, I mean, the Russos were involved in that too, so you'd think they're thinking a few steps ahead. They're very astute, yes.
Why is it that as soon as she inserts the USB that the whole thing powers on, there's no like on-off switch or whatever?
Well, because it's Zola responding to the presence of new information. He is in control of the facility is what I got. What I took from it.
Look at those spools moving. I love it.
Who are you to question what turns on Arnim Zola?
That's true. Everybody's got their fetishes.
If Scarlett Johansson put a USB drive in one of your ports, Greg, you'd probably be pretty turned on as well.
That's not for me to say, quite frankly. Actually, it is for me to say. I was going to say it actually kind of is for me to say, but I'm going to plead the second on that one.
The right to bear arms?
That's right. I don't know what that means, but I'm going to plead it in this case. Wow. Arnim Zola's face as a digital Matrix-like.
Yeah, I was going to say kind of a Matrix deal.
Yeah.
It's neat.
He's like a living like LED. It's like a light bright kind of thing.
Yeah, it's you know, not the fully realized version from the comics, but it kind of makes sense given that he's basically installed himself on what seems to be like Commodore 64s and whatnot.
Tim, mm-hmm. I'd have to say that Arnim Zola is not a good looking young man.
No, probably not. You know, if he had any dealings with the Barbarian, what do you think the Barbarian might have said to Arnie Zola?
Arnim Zola! Come over here,
you jerk me off, Arnim Zola.
You insert my USB!
This is good.
This is good. Okay. And they're talking Zola. Zola is... We apologize. We have completely thrown the format out the window, ladies and gentlemen. We've talked about Pierce's. We've talked about whatever the hell we were just talking about.
Have you guys ever seen that weird it always comes up in one of those like creepiest pirated broadcasts or whatever. It was a guy who literally hijacked a signal to a local news station, I think in Chicago or maybe a suburb of Chicago. And basically he was wearing like a weird mask and he made all these strange sounds, and it was only a couple seconds, but literally if you were watching the news, all of a sudden it would have cut over to this character. If you knew what I was talking about, you'd probably.
I do know what you're talking about. Yes, I've read about this. Yep.
Okay. Well, I bring this up only to point out that Zola's, I guess, avatar here, the way he's represented, kind of reminds me of that dude, the way he looked.
Yes, I can see that. Yeah, and it's so weird. That video is very, very weird.
It's unsettling.
But yeah, I agree. I can see that. I really like this history of Hydra deal. Now, what I'm not clear on is, are these old, outdated television screens and computers that are showing like up to date, high definition images of things, or is this kind of like a movie montage type deal where it's illustrating what Zola is telling us?
That's a good question.
Are Cap and Widow seeing these images, or is it just the viewer that's seeing these images?
Well, they actually showed some of the images on the screen a minute ago, like on one of the computer screens. So I don't know. It's hard to tell, really.
What do you guys think about the physics of Cap's shield in this movie? I really, really dug it. How it bounces off of things unrealistically, but very much like in the comic books. I, I, I'm a big mark for any time he gets to throw the shield and bounce it off stuff.
Yeah, it feels like they really stepped up the usage of the shield in the action scenes in this one. Like you said, making multiple bounces off things. It almost at times looks like he's playing the cheap version of Ultimate Alliance where you just throw the shield and steer it around the room and not really have to do anything because that's a tactic you could use whenever you were controlling Cap back in the day.
Yes, and I think the Russos actually mentioned at some point that they purposely stepped up the shield foo in this movie, so to speak. And definitely it is always a pleasure to see that shield get thrown and bounce around, ricochet, take a bunch of guys out. As Spider-Man pointed out, that thing does not obey the laws of physics, but that's why we love it.
Absolutely.
So
it's kind of like Daredevil's extendable cane. It's one of those things that, like, the less realistic it is, the more I enjoy it because I have always loved the images of Daredevil where the cane just appears to have, like, what would be about 400 yards of steel cable in it, and it's wrapped around him in all these nonsensical ways that would probably tie him into a knot if they ever came back together, you know?
Or Batman's cape.
Yeah,
Batman's cape that looks normal when it's on him, and then when he jumps from a building, it extends to approximately 400 feet in width.
Yes, absolutely. But are we assuming that's the end of Arnim Zola, or does he live on somewhere in digital form?
Pierce actually mentions that they had to sacrifice Zola, and he seemed quite put out by that. So Pierce, at least, is under the impression that he's gone, but you sort of wonder. I mean, he's got to be backed up somewhere, right?
Maybe he could be like Hank Henshaw, where he could never truly die. He just continues living on in digital form.
This little short scene right here, by the way, is probably one of my favorite Pierce scenes in the movie. Like, you guys were talking earlier about how understated his performance is, and then when the housekeeper comes back in here in a minute and he kind of reacts with this, like, resigned wince or whatever rather than this big dramatic show, it's a really great moment and kind of adds so much.
Really
to
wish
character.
You'd knocked. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I love how they shoot Winter Soldier's eyes.
Yes.
Where pretty much all that you can see are the eyes in the scene. It's very effective. It's
creepy. To this point, he hasn't unmasked. Yeah. So I think they're trying to maintain for those who may not know, that aura of mystique, even though they had kind of given it away in the trailers to this point. But you know how it is, Greg. There's always somebody who walks into the theater having not seen the trailers and is legitimately surprised by it.
And someone who doesn't know the comics and stuff like that, which is great. And the other thing that I love is there was even that implication still to that point of – because remember, in the prior scene, they say call in the asset. And so there's the thought that Winter Soldier is being called to assassinate Pierce potentially. Mm-hmm. At least there's a possibility of that. And even though I didn't really think that at that point, I knew he was the villain. But for those who are watching the movie blind, there's that chance that, oh, crap, when Pierce sees him, he's shocked. And you wonder if Pierce is resigning himself to the fact that he's about to be assassinated. But he's not. They even made a point of shooting the gun on the table. So really, really great scene. Among many in this film. So we've talked a little bit about the action scenes. We've talked about the addition of Anthony Mackie as the Falcon. We've talked about the plot, the dialogue. Let's talk about some of the casting in this film. I feel like as it has been the case with pretty much, I would say to this point, all of the MCU films, the casting has been impeccable. We know Black Widow and Cap and Nick Fury from prior movies, but we get Pierce, who we've already talked about, who is played by the outstanding Robert Redford. We get of course, Anthony Mackie as the Falcon. We get Crossbones. We get several new additions to the cast. Performance-wise, what did you make of the performances in this one? I think that this was a new level for pretty much all of these people. Like, Scarlett was about the same as usual, although she's really good in this one too, of course. But I thought Chris Evans even got to ratchet up his performance a little bit and show us a little more of that tragic side of Captain America from what we got to see in the first Avenger. What did you guys think of the performances across the board here?
Yeah, I would agree. These are all pretty outstanding performances. I actually think Scarlett, this may be one of her better turns. I kind of like what they're doing with her and her kind of, you know, trying to play multiple, like, not both sides, but like three or four sides at a time. Because, you know, she's kind of early in the film trying to keep Steve in the dark about Fury's true intentions. And then later on, she's kind of playing it a little bit more vulnerable. So I think she in particular gives one of her better performances in the entire MCU to date. Anthony Mackie, as you said earlier, Greg, really kind of walks in and holds his own from the get-go. Nick Fury, as a result of probably having more to do in this film than any other MCU film to date, you know, Samuel L. Jackson gives a hell of a performance. We already touched on Robert Redford as Alexander Pierce, which is outstanding. But yeah, pretty much across the board, the performances in this one are very good to great. And of course, you can't talk about the performances without talking about Chris Evans. But, you know, Chris Evans, as we said about Robert Downey Jr., it's kind of like, at this point in the MCU, it's just kind of like ho-hum, another great Chris Evans performance, because you kind of almost take it for granted at this point just how much he embodies this version of Captain America.
Yeah, Tim, your thoughts?
I think I really want to run my fingers through his hair right now. But in terms of the performances, to echoing what Nick said all around, these characters are so well written here and given a lot of nuance that that's well served by their respective actors, for sure.
Gary Shandling.
I think maybe the – go ahead.
I said Gary Shandling as he makes his
– yeah, Senator Stern. Here we go. Outed as an agent of Hydra. I think maybe if there's a weak link in terms of the actors, and it's not its fault, but it's Sebastian Stan's Winter Soldier. He
I would agree.
He just doesn't have a lot in terms of being a character. So most of his acting is, it's a lot of physical acting, you know, where a lot of guttural grunts and, you know, certainly a lot of action, a lot of movement. And
I will give him a little bit of credit, though. His eyes do tell a good story in this.
Yes, very much so. But I mean, that's to take nothing away from the role that he serves here. It's just almost like, did he really deserve the breastular billing that he received?
I was very concerned about him going into this movie because I thought he was kind of a weak link in the first movie. I thought he was very ho-hum and unremarkable. Even the writing of his role wasn't great in the first movie, I thought. And I think he at least showed me a little bit of physical charisma in this, even though certainly, to your point, he kind of is the least of the main players here. But yeah, I certainly agree with that. But yeah, I agree with you guys. The performances across the board are pretty stellar. I think, you know, maybe Jasper Sitwell isn't the best actor in the world, the guy that plays him, but he's not bad. Mm, yeah. And he serves his role in this movie as, you know, guy who gets comically killed in a few minutes when he gets yanked out of the car by Winter Soldier. So kind of – I guess we're kind of ready to tie a bow on this, but what are some of your favorite scenes in this movie, maybe one or two of your favorite scenes that maybe we – or especially one that we maybe haven't talked about yet or gotten to yet? Tim, I'll start with you.
Well, I do love that opening action scene on the – what's it called? The Lemurian star, the aircraft carrier basically – which reference to the comics there with Lemuria. Easy for me to say. I'll get it right eventually. But yeah, just for what that represents of having a minor villain that's well served, hits the ground running, which is always welcome in an action film like this. But in terms of favorites, boy, it's hard to go wrong with that first encounter between Steve and the Winter Soldier, where they're in the streets and it's all very in your face. I mean, you want to talk about clarity of fight choreography, definitely on display in that scene, which I think we've all been sort of hinting around and alluding to. So probably no surprise there. But I mean, they're even in the climax when they have their rematch on the helicarrier, works pretty damn well. Steve gets super messed up, which I don't think I realized watching this in the theater. I mean, he gets shot like 3 or 4 times and stabbed several times over as
and
well.
Beaten in the face.
It sit well in comical fashion, by the way.
Yeah, yanked out of the car.
And just thrown into oncoming traffic.
But I think either their first match or their rematch, I would have to say, gets my nod for favorite scenes.
Yeah, you kind of took the words out of my mouth. Both of those scenes are amazing. I mentioned the scene earlier with GSP in it as well, and then really just the whole. Movie has one scene after another that grips me and impresses me. I really enjoyed Fury getting to exact his revenge on Pierce at the end, even though in hindsight maybe it was a little anticlimactic of a death scene for such an important character, but that one stands out. And then the scene at the hospital, I really, really loved that scene at the hospital because it was a side of Natasha that you don't really see much in these movies. They did a little bit more in Age of Ultron, but really enjoyed it. Nick, what are some that stand out to you, or one or two maybe that we haven't talked about?
Yeah, I mean, as both of you guys mentioned, this scene that we're actually about to see right now,
right,
as we watch – this particular action scene is one of the best action scenes in the MCU. I really love, I know we've already talked about it, but that Nick Fury car chase / escape scene from early in the film where we see the Winter Soldier for the first time. I thought that one was so cool just because, like we said, you know, since this is kind of a spy movie / political thriller, getting to see some of that cool gadgetry and stuff was something I really marked out for. And then, of course, as you mentioned, Greg, that closing fight on the helicarrier, the rematch between Steve and Bucky is just outstanding and probably one of the better examples of just a straight-up fight choreography that the MCU has put on film to this point. So pretty much any time there's an action scene, this one just kind of raises the bar and knocks it out of the park in a way that not many MCU films have done to date, and specifically not really any that haven't been directed by the Russo brothers have done, honestly. Those two have kind of established themselves as the cream of the crop when it comes to action directors in the MCU.
So I only mentioned this because I teased it earlier, but how does Maria Hill end up getting in that Hydra shield van as one of the Hydra agents?
She infiltrates. It's the only she does a generic spy infiltration is the only thing I can come up with.
Yeah, we sort of forgot she was in this movie, and possibly the Russos forgot she was in this movie too. Maybe there's a deleted scene or something that
they set her up. They set
her
up with Fury calling her, you know, right before he gets attacked earlier in the film, and then you see her at the hospital, and you're like, well, that's all she's here for, and then she kind of pops up here.
Right. Yeah, there are a few deleted scenes on this Blu-ray that I haven't watched, so maybe there is one. I don't know, but it just that's one thing. That's the only thing really that struck me this time when I was watching it. And I was like, wait a minute, how? It's almost like one of those Nigel Powers in Goldmember. You know, just fall down. You know how this works. but yeah, so. This movie really blew me away on rewatch. It blew me away the first time I watched it, but I think the first time I watched it, I maybe wasn't as impressed as most people were. And then I watched it again, and I liked it even more. And now this latest rewatch, I probably liked it the most of any of the times I've watched it. How did this play out for you guys?
Yeah, this is kind of like the first Captain America movie in that pretty much every time I watch any of these Captain America movies, I enjoy them more and more. It's like they just have this rewatchability factor. not to say that any of the other MCU films aren't really watchable, but these I just pick up on new things that I love or new things that I didn't catch the first time around on each subsequent rewatch. So these are probably the most rewatchable films in all the MCU.
Yeah. Like you, Greg, I will say I wasn't as blown away as it seemed like most people were the first time around. But after thinking on it and letting it settle, for a few days, I sort of would find myself thinking back to the movie and remembering things and appreciating some of the subtleties. And like I said, this being only the second time I've watched it again in its entirety, enjoyed it even more. I don't know that I like it that much more than the first movie, in all honesty, for various different reasons. But it is definitely a high watermark in the MCU. For a lot of people, this is their favorite of any of the films, and I think that's well deserved.
Well, that it's funny you should mention that, because that actually brings us to our increasingly difficult part of the show, where we provide our rankings. Nick, are you prepared with the critical consensus on these films?
You want to go critical consensus first?
Well, I'm going to leave it up to you, since you're the one that has the master list.
Yeah, let's go critical consensus first. And do you want to go at this point 9-1 or 1-9?
9-1 makes sense to me. And do you are we going to read the actual scores as well, or how is that going to work?
No. So basically, what I'll give this caveat again, as we do every time we do one of these critical scores are a combination of the Rotten Tomatoes score. The Rotten Tomatoes critic score, the Rotten Tomatoes fan score, and the Metacritic score. So each of those on a scale of 100, meaning that the highest possible total you can have for all three is 300. So from 9-1 now, with the Winter Soldier included, we've got Thor: The Dark World at number 9 with 196, The Incredible Hulk at number 8 with 199, Iron Man 2 at number 7 with 201, Thor at number 6 with 210, Iron Man 3 at number 5 with 219. Captain America, the First Avenger, at number 4 with 220. And then there's a big jump, because all the way up there at number 3, we've got this one, Captain America, the Winter Soldier, with 251. At number 2, edging out Winter Soldier by just a single point, we've got the Avengers with 252. And then finally, you've got Iron Man, still the critical darling of the MCU with 264. So Winter Soldier coming in at third, according to the critics and fans, right behind Iron Man and the Avengers. That's a hell of a spot for one of the later entries in the MCU.
And as we do with each of our guests on the Hard Travelers for Hire, we will get their rankings as well. But in order to give you a moment to process your thoughts, Tim, we'll go ahead and give our rankings. And Nick, would you like us to go in reverse order or regular order?
Sure, we'll go in reverse. And why don't you get us started, Greg, at number 9?
At number 9, I've got The Incredible Hulk. At number 8, I have Thor: The Dark World. At number 7, I have Thor. At number 6, I have Captain America: The First Avenger. At number 5, I have Iron Man. At number 4, I have Iron Man 3. At number 2, I have Iron Man. I'm sorry. At number 3, I have Iron Man 2. At number 2, I have the Avengers, and at number 1, I have Captain America: The Winter Soldier.
Wow.
Yep, I did it. I didn't think I would do it, but I did
it. You did it. You pulled the trigger. So this is your favorite of what you guys have watched so far.
Yeah, I never thought I would say that, but because I love the Avengers. The Avengers is like sacred ground for me, but I got to say, man, this – this is the best this movie has been to me, this rewatch of it. I was blown away.
Mm.
Ooh. It's a unique situation. With mine, God, it's so hard. I'll go Iron Man 3 at 9, Incredible Hulk at 8, Thor the Dark World at 7, Iron Man 2 at 6, Captain America the First Avenger at 5, Thor at 4, Iron Man at 3. Oh. You know, I got to go Avengers at 2, and I got to go Captain America the Winter Soldier at 1 as well. I mean...
Oh, wow!
It's one that just... On this rewatch, I didn't feel like there was a down scene in the film. It's probably one of the more consistent films in the MCU, and the action is just on this whole other level. Granted, it doesn't have anything, I think, as, you know, a fanboy... orgasm inducing as that closing Battle of New York scene in the Avengers, but it's just got this level of consistency and this tension to it that none of the MCU films outside of perhaps Civil War have really been able to top to this point. So yeah, I gotta go Winter Soldier at number one, which is not something I was anticipating before this most recent rewatch.
All right, Tim, as our guest of honor for our Canadian fans, You have to give us your rankings. Now, we're not going to ask you to go from 9 to 1 if you don't want to, because that can be confusing given some of the numbers and whatnot with the Iron Man 2 and 3 and Captain America 7 and all that stuff. So,
well, let's try. I'll do my best here. Man, you guys are like pure pressuring me into it here with the rankings and the love for this movie, but all right, let me go worst in quotes is going to be Iron Man 3. Then Incredible Hulk. Yeah, it's going to be similar to your list, Nick. Then Thor the Dark World. Probably, yeah, Iron Man 2. Thor, gosh, now it's getting hard. I guess Cap, First Avenger, then Winter Soldier, Iron Man, Avengers. Is that all of them?
That's all of them. You
yes,
got it.
That's
you
all.
Nailed it on
very
first
good.
Attempt.
Very good. And not to tell too many tales out of school, we're cheating because we actually have a document out in front of us that has our okay. rankings to this
okay.
point. So you managed to do that from the top of your head, which is very good. I remember
we're not that many movies deep just yet.
That's true. We put Todd in a rough situation on our last one because he'd had a few to drink on that one, and we put him in a bit of a bind with the rankings there. But nevertheless, we soldiered on. He soldiered on, and now you have Winter Soldiered on, Tim.
Oh, see, that was well done, sir.
Yes, that may be my crowning achievement as a podcaster, which may lead to me retiring at this point.
No,
I think that
Comic Book Theater is undoubtedly all our crowning achievements as podcasters.
Well, I was going to suggest, Nick, I could be replaced by Conrad Thompson.
Oh.
We have similar physiques, similar looks, similar accents.
Similar tastes in football teams. There you are.
Similar carpentry skills.
Roll Tide.
Roll Tide on that. So anyway, yeah, glad that all three of us enjoy this movie so much. If you guys have listened to this podcast and you haven't gathered by now that we're huge fans of this movie, then you haven't been paying attention, and I can't blame you. I wouldn't pay attention either if I were you. But nevertheless, you should pay attention to this movie. That notwithstanding, go pick it up at your local movie stand that sells movies and buy it or rent it and watch it. It's good. Anything to add past my towering praise of this film, gentlemen?
No, I think You know, this is one of those films that just continues to amaze me every time I watch it. I enjoy it every. I mean, it's one of those movies that, like, you know, Tim said earlier, it's on FX all the time, and I constantly find myself, you know, sucked in for at least a scene or two. But this was the first time I've sat down and watched it from beginning to end in a long time, and man, what a fun ride it is! And kudos to the Russo brothers, who have kind of really cemented themselves as the premier directors in the MCU to this point.
Tim, who's your favorite Russo brother, and why is it Vince?
Because he's not so much a nice looking young man as he is a somewhat ruggedly scruffy looking middle aged muskrat of a man. Anyway, less importantly than all that, I am just really really touched and impressed by the love and affection that you two gentlemen have showed for my favorite character in these series of films. Credit, yeah, to the Russos and Kevin Feige and the Marvel Cinematic Universe for doing right by Cap. That's my man, you know?
Absolutely, yeah. This is that's how we're going to feel, Nick and I, if they ever make a good Green Lantern movie. Which will never happen.
Which is doubtful.
Well,
at this point,
perhaps
yeah.
Not. Will that lead to more bed-breaking sex due to weight?
Yes. If that happens, if we mark it down here, folks, we are making this vow to our listening audience. If and when a good Green Lantern movie is made, Nick and I will recreate our legendary bed-breaking sex from the night we met in Troy.
In the L-shaped studio.
You're saying we'll recreate it, not recreate it on the podcast, right?
We'll put it up to a vote. We will see what the people want. If the people want to hear the L-shaped sex, then they can hear the L-shaped sex. But I'm just saying, if we get a movie, or God forbid, a movie series that does for the Green Lantern what this movie series has done for Captain America. Honestly, Nick, won't it be worth it?
Oh, yeah, totally. Absolutely. It won't just be worth it. Yes, it'll be worth it.
So, with that being said, folks.
Green Lantern, we love you, buddy. Pulling for you.
You come over here, you jerk me off. we do want to give Tim a chance to promote himself and his brand. Nick and I are both in businesses that teach us a lot about branding opportunities and infrastructure, synergistic approaches to the corporate landscape. Mm-hmm. And so, Tim, do you have any podcasts or anything or any appearances that you'd like to promote here on the Hard Traveling Fanboys?
Well, for God's sakes, if I have a brand, we're in deep shit. Also on Place to Be Nation Pop, there is a show known as Conversation Comics with Todd Weber that is produced and hosted by Todd Weber, if you can believe it. And we have been a little distracted right now. We have been running down the Claremont Burn tenure on Uncanny X-Men. So that entire run, we are steeped in the Dark Phoenix saga currently. So still quite a few issues to go, but that's been a really enjoyable podcast series. And I'm so grateful to Todd for having me on and continuing to indulge me, because
it's been great. You guys are going word by word, panel by panel. It's incredibly entertaining, especially for people like me who have not experienced that era of X-Men. It's been really enlightening and informative and super entertaining.
Well, yeah, and we encourage anyone to read and follow along with the issues or with your Marvel Unlimited subscription. So, yeah, check it out. But that's been a blast to do. So hopefully we'll be getting together again soon to continue that series and eventually actually finish it out. There aren't too terribly many left in that run, so we'll get there. Beyond that, my sort of semi-regular gig on the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, Survey Says, a WCW retrospective, which at points it has felt like this show has been. But I know I'm always in good company with the hard travelers for hire in this case. But yeah, check out Survey Says on Place to Be Nation Wrestling, myself and co-pilot, co-captain Andy Helene, running down all the great years in World Championship Wrestling. So, yeah.
But not Jim Crockett Promotions.
And Jim Crockett, well, sometimes.
Some Jim Crockett Promotions.
Sorry. Some Jim Crockett Promotions. We did 1989 with Todd Weber, bringing it back full circle. So that was a lot of fun. I think that's it in terms of where I've been, where you can find me.
Where can people find you on social media?
Social media. If you would like to follow me on Twitter, I am at Cyke68. That's Cyke68 on Twitter. Place to Be Nation Facebook group as well. Certainly Place to Be Nation Comics I am somewhat sometimes active in, depending on the topic in the day. But yeah.
Absolutely. And of course, Nick and I can be found on Twitter. I am at gphillips8652. He is at nickduke87. You can also contact us through our rarely used, the loneliest email accounts on the internet, folks. Greg P. at placetobenation.com and Nick D. at placetobenation.com.
I should check that.
Loneliest emails on the internet. And of course, you can join Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook, as Tim just mentioned. If you'd like to send me a Facebook friends request, you're welcome to. I will probably deny it, but you are welcome to attempt it. And
the Blockmaster, Greg Phillips.
The Blockmaster, Greg Phillips. I have received 3 friend requests from anonymous, incredibly attractive Miami Dolphins fans today, and I've denied all 3.
Why? Mm.
Well, because I doubt that they are actual people.
Well, you don't know that, though, Greg. Give them the benefit of the doubt. As you know, I have had certainly some unique interactions with my followers on Twitter over the last week.
On Twitter, yes. And the other thing, Nick, one of them was Larry Zonka.
Oh. Now, if it had been Mercury Morris, you would have accepted it in a heartbeat.
Yes, Mercury Morris is awesome. I would love – Mercury Morris could actually get me to drink champagne with him. That's how awesome Mercury Morris is. But nevertheless, that notwithstanding,
quite frankly,
more importantly than all that,
it's been it's been a romp'em stomp'em affair here at Hard Travelers for Hire, as we've talked about the Donnybrook that was Captain America, the Winter Soldier, seesaw matchup between Captain America and the Winter Soldier, and. Are there any more Vince McMahon cliches? I think I've run out of them from the announcer years.
None that I can think of. None that I can
one, two,
think
of. He got him? No, he didn't? I don't know. The Heartbreak Kid Shawn Michaels did not appear in this film. Join us next time on the Hard Travelers for Hire when we will be discussing Guardians of the Galaxy, something of a landmark film in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. That one by James Gunn. We don't know who we're going to be joined by for that one, do we, Nick?
No, we don't have a guest in place, but luckily we've got some time to figure it out as we are taking a couple months off. That one won't actually be dropping until December.
That's right. As if we needed to delay this project more, we're taking a few months off to do a couple of theme months. Walking Dead and...
We've got a special Thor and Justice League month in November as we celebrate the releases of both Thor Ragnarok and Justice League. So we're going to be doing feature-length shows for each of those film releases, as well as some reviews of some classic Thor and Justice League stories from the comics.
And then in December, we're completely changing things up, and we're actually abandoning comic books for the month, and we're doing a series of shows about the American Ninja film series starring Ooh. Michael Dudikoff.
Ooh. Oh.
So look forward to that, ladies and gentlemen. But that being said, thank you very much to Tim Capel for taking time out of his day to join us, and always, always we have fun talking to Tim, and we'll have him on certainly in the near future. And again, we want to take this opportunity to encourage you to listen to Comic Book Theater, or don't. That's your decision. I'm just putting it out there as an option. So thanks to Tim for joining us. We hope you enjoyed this portion of the show. And again, hit us up on social media. Enjoy this wonderful commercial break where you'll hear about all the podcasts at Place to Be Nation and Place to Be Nation Pop.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we offer those to you on three great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the original Place to Be podcast, as well as Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows, as well as the Our Vantage Point podcast and Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver quick-hit pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Psychology is Dead, Puro Potpourri, Stacy and Elliot's Bogus Journey, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Letters from Center Stage, Space City, an NWA Classics On Demand adventure, Through the Years, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, and much more. And on our popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, Go Home in a Box, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, Geek and Sassy, and Imaginary Stories podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including the Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to all of our feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows plus others available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when shopping online, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keats' Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Big thing happened during the break. our guest Tim Capel left our show and actually went and defended his Western States Heritage Championship and has lost it to a returning Larry Zbyszko. Nick, I didn't see this coming when Tim left the show just a few minutes ago.
No, nor did I, but I have no doubt that he lost due to the fact that he was able to finally best Larry Zbyszko at a game of human chess, which no one has ever really been able to do in the past. So
that's true. The game of human chess is one that is a long-form game, a marathon, not a sprint, you might say, the opposite of the hard-traveling fanboys. Bedroom exploits, but that's neither here nor there. Let's get to a segment that we like to call
Reading and Watching. What you been reading and watching?
What you been reading and watching?
That's right, it's Reading and Watching.
I was about to say, what segment is that, Greg?
Well, you just heard the jingle, did you not?
I did. I did just hear the jingle. That's true.
And we're going to start off with an abbreviated version of Reading and Watching today. Let's kick it off with reading. I have read exactly two comic books in the last week and am prepared to discuss them. Nick, how many have you read?
I don't even know how many I've read, but I didn't even bring them for discussion because I have had such a hectic week that even if I tried to discuss them, I wouldn't be able to discuss them very eloquently. So just hold off on mine for next week. And for the first time in recorded history, Greg has reading and I don't. So I'll let Greg take it away from here.
This is my moment. And I'm not going to have them ranked or tiered or anything. I'm just going to discuss them. You'll get my thoughts on which one I liked better. But the first is going to be a continuing theme for me on this show as I continue to try to catch up on Aquaman by Dan Abnett. In this case, it's Aquaman number 16, Peace in Our Time. Actually, no, this is not that one. This is the wrong comic that I grabbed. It was actually Aquaman number 17, which is the start of the Warhead storyline. And that is a comic that I believe had art by Scott Eaton and not Brad Walker, if I'm not mistaken. And this introduces a new villain character of Warhead, who I could take or leave at least one issue in. I'm interested to find out more about this character, but nothing special. However, the book as a whole, it continues to be phenomenal. I would say that of all of the Rebirth books that I'm reading regularly, I think Aquaman might have, along with Wonder Woman, the most compelling cast of characters besides the lead character, if that makes sense. Obviously, there's Hal Jordan in the Green Lantern Corps, but as far as a solo book, it is just incredible to me how Abnett has gotten me over the course of 17 issues to care about so many characters, even Merc, who's a very minor character, just a kind of a military leader guy. I care about him. And I want to see him survive, and I want to hear his interactions with other characters. The police officer that is in a small town that had a crush on Arthur when he was younger. All these characters just continue to add up to this rich tapestry that makes Aquaman one of my favorite books in the Rebirth Initiative. Abnett continues to write it extremely, extremely well. And then my other book is Green Arrow number 15 by Ben Percy and Juan Ferreira. And this is part of Emerald Outlaw, which continues to, for me, be a pretty underwhelming storyline. Again, the dialogue is pretty on the nose and pretty mediocre in my view. The art's good. I do like the rogue cops who are in this one that form their own little – I'm trying to remember what they call themselves in this. It's a pretty generic name. But they're kind of an interesting angle to it, and I liked the return of Amico at the end. It was very exciting, very cool to see. But again, I have some issues where sometimes Percy's dialogue takes me out of the book at times. And I wish that wasn't the case, but it just is for me. Even though I'm still enjoying the book, the art is kind of the main draw for me at this point. It's so good. And the and of course, I do love the characters. I just wish the dialogue could be written a little bit smoother. And that's my reading.
Interesting. Interesting. Well, with all that being said, Greg, why don't we move on to our next recurring segment?
Yes. Oh, we don't have any watching, do we?
No, none.
None to speak of. Yes, our next recurring segment is our weekly look at the news and notes in the world of comics. And that is a segment, of course, known as...
Welcome to the Rundown, where we talk some comic news. Welcome to the Rundown, where we talk about movies too.
Bruce Pritchard. So... we are going to get started with a bit of news out of Spider-Man Homecoming, which was the Marvel Cinematic Universe relaunch of the Spider-Man character earlier this summer. The news that came out is that the writers of Homecoming, Chris McKenna and Eric, don't call me Scott Summers, will return to write a sequel to the Sony Pictures Marvel Studios joint production. This according to The Hollywood Reporter. McKenna and Summers have also worked on the upcoming Ant-Man and the Wasp, which seems like a natural fit, Nick, given the comedic elements that were associated with Homecoming. Also, director John Watts is still in talks to return to helm the sequel. Certainly, this is good news. I think both of us enjoyed the film. You liked it, I think, a little bit more than I did, but we both really liked it. And I think this is more of a good thing is a good thing.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. It's going to provide a level of continuity in terms of the production from the first one to the second one and hopefully set the stage for an improvement, which is kind of what I'm hoping to see, even though I have made no secret of the fact that I was a massive fan of the first one. But I'm hoping for that next big leap forward for the Spider-Man franchise in the sequel.
Ah, leap forward. I like it. Mm-hmm. As am I. And let's move on from the MCU to the DCTU television universe, that is, as we're going into the upcoming DC streaming service, which is going to be kind of spearheaded by two shows, Young Justice, which we've talked about a lot on the show, and Titans, the upcoming live-action show based on the Marv Wolfman, George Perez, New Teen Titans. And we finally, and this is a big moment for me, we finally have a casting announcement for the most important of the Titans, Dick Grayson, a.k.a. Nightwing, a.k.a. my favorite comic book character. A gentleman named Brenton Thwaites has been cast as Dick Grayson in Titans. And Grayson is said to be the series' central character. And the show will focus on his transition from Robin to Nightwing. This actor, Brenton Thwaites, I don't know a damn thing about him, but I will say all that I can go off of are his images on a Google image search. And I can say he looks like Dick Grayson to me. He looks like Dick should look. Wait a minute. Let me rephrase. He looks like Dick Grayson should look, in my opinion. And I don't know if he can act or not, but I have to give him the benefit of the doubt. So as far as just like looking like a character, he looks the part. I'm going to give him a shot. I haven't seen Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Men Tell No Tales, which is probably his most famous role to this point. But he looks like he's been in a lot of smaller films and stuff. He's also been in Oculus and Gods of Egypt, neither of which I've seen. But what are your thoughts on this casting announcement?
Yeah, like Nick? You, I have no real thoughts because I don't know much about him. But I do want to ask you a question. Now, you've probably done your research into Mr. Thwaites, but here's an important question. Have you Googled a picture of his butt?
I have not.
Okay. That's just something that some people have been doing, apparently, to determine if he really has the acting chops to play Dick Grayson.
Do you know who also would have the chops to play Dick Grayson, Nick?
Who's that?
Nature Boy Ric Flair. No, I haven't Googled his butt. However, I am curious to see how much of his butt will be shown in his scenes with Starfire on the show.
Oh.
I mean, there's no restrictions on a streaming service, right?
Yeah, it just depends on how, you know, how teen-friendly they're wanting to be with the Teen Titans aspect.
That's a very good part. Point, rather. Not part, but point.
Are you saying that his butt is a very good part?
That notwithstanding, it's going to be a raucous affair when we move on to a segment we like to call the DCEU Corner, quite frankly.
DCEU Corner.
And in the DCEU Corner, we're going to lead off with a clarification of a topic that really set us off a couple weeks ago. A topic that really got our blood boiling. A topic that grinded our gears. And that is a clarification from the Batman director, Matt Reeves, about his comments on a podcast many months ago that recently made the news for some reason, in that he said that the Batman film that he's working on would not be part of the DCEU. We, of course, took that to mean, well, shit, it's not going to be tied in with any of the other movies. It's going to be a standalone. Not what he meant. Here's what he says. His quote is, "Geez, what did I miss, guys?" This is on Twitter. "Just to be clear, of course Batman will be part of the DC Universe. Batman will be Batman. In my comments from a while back about not being part of the DCEU, I was talking about the Batman being a story specifically about Batman, not about the others in the universe. That it wouldn't be filled with cameos servicing other stories, that it would be a Batman story." Which we probably would have known if we had listened to the entire podcast that he was on and heard it in context. But Nick, I'm very happy to read this, very happy to hear this, and it's a pretty damning indictment of the current state of entertainment media coverage.
Yeah, and a pretty damning indictment of us as we jumped on Absolutely. It and decided to talk about it. But what can you do?
What can you do? Nevertheless, I'm going to say nevertheless once more as we transition into yet another Batman-related DCEU story. And that is a report that I am just now reading for the very first time. So, Nick, if you'd like to take over and lead this topic, it would be wonderful.
Yes, and of course, the report that Greg is talking about is a report that came out kind of as a follow-up to the rumors a Martin Scorsese produced, Todd Phillips directed, not in the DCEU standalone Joker origin movie. And the report, according to the Hollywood Reporter, is that unnamed sources claim that current Joker star Jared Leto, who played the character in Suicide Squad, was caught off guard by the rumors for a non-continuity Joker film, and he is said to have made his displeasure with the notion of multiple Jokers known to his agents, and that a rival agency has been using the concern to court him, although he reportedly remains on board for a Harley Joker spinoff from Suicide Squad. So apparently Jared Leto not happy, although apparently it would seem he's more upset with his agency than he is the studio. And what does it all mean? Absolutely nothing, in all likelihood.
Yes, it means that an actor is not happy about something.
Which is good for them. We're not happy either about the film, Jared, if it makes you feel any better. One of the rare things we can agree on in as it relates to the Joker.
Very good. Well, speaking of the Joker, we mentioned in the last episode that, as we hinted at and maybe even talked about a moment ago, Warner Brothers is working on a standalone Joker movie, a solo Joker film outside the DCEU, and yes, actually outside the DCEU, that will be part of an Elseworlds line of films, for lack of a better term. And a report came out this week, according to, there's that publication again, The Hollywood Reporter, that Warner Brothers has its eyes set on Leonardo DiCaprio to star in this Joker film. The Hollywood Reporter indicates that the enlistment of Martin Scorsese as a producer, which is one of the rumors associated with this project, was done in part to help broach a better relationship with Leonardo, as the director and actor, of course, have collaborated on 5 films together, most of them excellent in nature. So WB wants DiCaprio, quote, or another A-lister, end quote, to play the Joker as a, quote, gritty crime boss in a Scorsese-esque Gotham underworld, end quote. Two aspects of this. We'll get to the more eye-catching one in a second. But I just want to say, isn't a gritty crime boss what we just got with the Joker in Suicide Squad? I don't know.
Yeah, I guess they mean a more like down, a more realistic gritty crime boss, and not something bathed in neon and, you know, running around wearing furry heads and stuff for his henchmen. I think they mean a little bit more grounded. But either way, it seems to be a pretty redundant take on the character. And again, this whole idea is stupid.
The number two aspect, DiCaprio as the Joker, I have no problems with.
Oh no, that would be awesome for sure.
Yeah,
but I don't think it's actually going to happen.
Yeah, so not a fan of this project still. If it happens and if we get DiCaprio as a version of the Joker, obviously we're going to be there to watch it. But again, not a fan of the project. Not convinced DiCaprio is going to actually take the role either. Now, we're going to close it out with a rare bit. And we always do this. If ever there is synergy between our two interests, we try to bring them together and cover them on the show. And in this case, it's a half synergistic deal between wrestling and comics. Because, as you guys know, Shazam/Captain Marvel is being fast-tracked by Warner Brothers. And they're wanting to get started on filming next year. The problem is they still don't have the lead role cast. As you know, Black Adam was cast many moons ago as The Rock. But reports have come out that The Rock, and aka Black Adam, will not be in the Shazam movie. And instead will get his own standalone movie and then meet Shazam later on. So the issue remains, who's going to play Shazam/Captain Marvel? Well, the hot rumor that is floating around, according to, and tell me if this doesn't sound like a reliable source of information, the Hashtag Show. The Hashtag Show is reporting that 2 actors are the front runners to play Captain Marvel in New Line Cinema's Shazam. One, who I know absolutely nothing about and don't care about, is Joshua Sassy. The other, who would play Black Adam's foe in the movie, potentially, according to this report, one, John Cena. So, what I'm asking, Nick, is could it be possible? Is it conceivable? Is it something that could happen in the realm of possibility that we could get thrice in a lifetime?
Yeah, I think thrice in a lifetime certainly is a possibility. And you have to think, if we actually got Cena versus Rock in a movie, that WWE would probably be killing themselves to jump all over some sort of wrestling tie-in.
Yeah. Backing the money truck up to both individuals,
yep.
In particular on Mr. Johnson to come back and do one more for all time. But in all honesty, this is actually – I didn't think it would ever actually – and it still hasn't become a reality, but I didn't think it was ever realistic at the time. But Russell, our friend, has been kind of advocating for this for quite some time. And I got to say, after seeing him in some movies – I could see it. I could see Cena pulling this off. Now, Nick, as a noted and longtime disparager of Mr. Cena, what are your thoughts?
I haven't watched any of his recent film appearances. Been meaning to get around to Trainwreck and haven't had a chance to do so yet. So can't really comment on his recent film output. But, you know, if you're looking for somebody to play the big red cheese, so to speak, I guess, you know, some of the stuff that Cena does in his wrestling persona – some of the hokier stuff would kind of lend itself. the key to this film, more so than who plays Shazam, is going to be who they get to play Billy Batson. Because as you know, good child actors are exceedingly rare, and this movie is going to kind of have to be carried by a pretty decent child performance. So I think that's the one
we
really need to be paying attention to in the coming weeks and months.
Yeah, no reason that Cena couldn't pull off being Captain Marvel, but Billy Batson's going to need to be good, and that's why I think they should get the kid from Iron Man 3.
Huh. Well, certainly be a unique situation. Certainly be a unique, annoying situation if that were to happen.
Well, folks, we've come to the end of the line once more of another edition of the Hard Travelers for Hire, another edition of the Hard Traveling Fanboys. As you can feel outside, it's cold. It's getting dry. It's that typical Canadian September, isn't it, Nick?
Oh yeah, that Canadian September. Just it's so moderate.
It really is, and we want to get going and get on the road. As you know, we've both got long drives back to Alabama, separately, of course. And, it takes us a long time to drive back there every week after our show. And so we got to hit the road. But before we do, I wanted to put this out there. One of the great, great radio shows out there, the Paul Feinbaum Show, has a theme song written and performed by former American Idol Taylor Hicks. If any of you out there in the listening audience knows Mr. Hicks, we love him to record a very similar theme song for us.
Now,
in fact,
wait just
exact,
a minute. Wait.
The exact same theme song, just with the lyrics changed to call Greg and Nick.
I am not. No, I will not stand for this. I am not supportive of this, Greg. We have a wonderful, an outstanding theme song composed by the manager, Todd Weber. And here you are, openly soliciting new theme songs without consulting Todd first. And no, I won't stand for it, Greg. You, sir, are a Flandering, cheating, rat bastard is what you are. And Todd Weber shouldn't stand for it.
No, listen, I love – don't get me wrong. We have right now – what we have right now is the greatest theme song in pop culture. No one would dispute that. Not a single person has disputed that. Since this show started, we have the best theme song in the world.
Yeah.
What I am.
No, you've been caught in your philandering ways, and now you're trying to backtrack your way out of it.
No, he didn't philander. No, the what I'm trying to solicit from Taylor Hicks is an outro song. I want him to record a song to lead people into the next week. Of course, I'm going to lead into the show with our Hard Traveling theme song, because it's the best thing that's ever been written or recorded by man. What I want from Taylor Hicks is a song at the end to tell people that they can give us feedback. So it could be, email Greg and Nick. That'll make sense of it all.
That doesn't rhyme.
No. Ah, email Greg and Nick. Oh, you can suck a dick. Or something like that, you know?
Good.
Maybe that's too much.
Good Lord.
Is that too much? Too far?
Yeah, I think so. A bit too much.
Well, we've gone too far anyway. We hope you listened to the show. We hope you enjoyed it. We hope you give us feedback. And we hope, if you are Taylor Hicks, that you aren't offended by what we just did, that little bit there. And we'll talk to you next week, folks. So long. Are you gonna give me fucking anything on this show, or why are we even here?
Close enough to slap dick. Let me answer the fucking question. Give me a minute. Well, Klondike Bill told me that if he ever came across a woman who was extremely clean and well-kept, he would tell her to put on a pair of sweatpants and a sweatshirt, go take a 2-mile jog, and then come back and see him when she was done.
Thank you.
I travel fanboys.